Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app. With your help, we can continue to stand up for free speech, for open debate and rational discussion, reaching new audiences and bringing important information free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Visit realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference.
This is The Fourth Estate on RCR Reality Check Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to The Fourth Estate here on Reality Check Radio on Friday, the 2nd of August, 2024. I'm your host, Marty Gibson, and this week we're going to take a good look at the physical and financial disconnects between mainstream media and the dwindling number of people who still doggedly consume it. Luckily, I don't have to clean out these Augean stables alone. Joining me today, Rachel Stewart, is an ex-New Zealand Herald columnist, the 2016 Opinion Writer of the Year at the Canon Media Awards, and an all-around firebrand. Marie Buskey told me that she was New Zealand's first female train driver, which impressed me immensely, and I hope is true. And never having met her in person, I picture her in striped overalls and train driver's hat with a shotgun to see off Jesse James's gang. She writes at Writing Shotgun on Substack. Good morning, Rachel.
Yeah, good morning, Marty. How are you?
Good. Were you the first female New Zealand train driver?
Yeah. From what I understand, there was nobody else. That's right. It was 1983 and they said girls can do anything. So I did it.
Horsepower. Awesome.
Yeah, it was good. It was a good experience.
Yeah, I bet. Joining us also, the Heracles of New Zealand television himself, former broadcaster and now RCR host, Peter Williams was a regular fixture on television screens from the late 1970s to 2018. He consistently featured as New Zealand broadcasting's most engaging personalities, but like Neo in The Matrix, he woke up and was fired. I assume you sort of quit, but you're fired, before he went too far off script and woke up too many other Kiwis. He's found Zion in RCR as we battle the machines and relentlessly work to free those who are still haplessly plugged in. So good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Marty. Did you ever win a prize for creative writing or not?
For mixing metaphors?
Yeah.
No, I didn't. There's hope.
Well, there is after that.
Well, first up, a black mass is a ceremony celebrated by various satanic groups. It has allegedly existed for centuries in different forms. As far back as 1200 AD, there began to appear more cynical and heretical parodies of the Mass, also written in ecclesiastical Latin, known as drinkers' masses and gamblers' masses, which lamented the situation of drunk gambling monks, and instead of calling to Deus, God, called to Bacchus, the Roman god of wine. The modern form is intentionally a sacrilegious and blasphemous parody of a Catholic Mass. In the 19th century, the Black Mass became popularized in French literature, and it also formed a central part of the opening ceremony for the 2024 Paris Olympic Games, complete with a hefty lady playing Jesus, feasting on Bacchus, and surrounded by her disciples, children in drag, cavorting suggestively on transvestites, and gay men who appeared to have their balls hanging out. This was described in New Zealand state-owned media as spectacular, unprecedented, an extravaganza, and that's RNZ Radio New Zealand, and revolutionary and rule-breaking, a heavenly hymn to love and sport, and that's TV1. The New Zealand Herald described it as spectacular, bold, and original. And social media, as is usual these days, revealed a massive disconnect between our media lovies and ordinary Kiwis. Now, Peter, you like sport far more than I ever have or will. What makes Kiwis so transphobic and intolerant of heavenly satanic rituals?
Heaven forbid, Marty. I have no idea. But this was the Olympic Games opening ceremony. I have to say, I was not in New Zealand when it happened. I was in, of all places, New York. And it happened on Friday, New York time. It happened in the afternoon, New York time. I wasn't doing anything that particular Friday afternoon, but however, I was not in my hotel room. I watched at 7 o'clock that night as NBC had a full replay, or so they said, a full replay of the Olympic Games opening ceremony. And I thought, having seen a bit of social media and having seen that there'd been a bit of a kerfuffle about the depiction of what many said was Da Vinci's Last Supper, I thought I would watch it on NBC. Obviously, those powers that be at America's Olympic broadcaster decided it was all a bit too hot to handle. So after a little bit of an intro featuring, you know, luminaries such as Snoop Dogg and Kelly Clarkson, they just cut to the parade of athletes. So I actually haven't seen this particular part of the opening ceremony. In other words, all the theatre and the big extravaganza, the staged extravaganza before the march of the athletes, was not replayed to American audiences on prime time. That suggests it was a bit hot to handle. However, I have subsequently been told by the left lovies that it was not, in fact, a blasphemy of Da Vinci's Last Supper in drag. It was, in fact, the heathen gods gathered on Mount Olympus for a feast. So therefore, it was Bacchus and Neptune and Diana and Venus, all based on a Dutch artist's painting from 1635, Jan van Bylert. And that was the inspiration for this particular piece of Olympic theatre.
Oh, my mistake.
Like I say, Marty, I didn't see it. I'm not particularly interested. For me, the Olympics are about sports and about competition, not about theatre in the opening ceremony.
Yeah, well, there was a fair bit of other stuff in there as well. There were the white horse of the apocalypse, and there was a dance which featured people appearing to get a sudden attack of myocarditis and falling on the floor. Rachel, what were your impressions of it? Did you catch it?
No, I didn't, but I went back because I could see the furore had started. And basically, Peter, the lefty lovey's lied to you, because it definitely is a depiction of the Last Supper, and it is, and the IOC admitted that, and then they changed their mind and said something else, and then they went back to admitting it. So it's all over the show. I think we all know that it is a depiction of mocking Christianity, which is fine. Mocking's good, but not at the Olympics, I don't think. Mocking is fine, but they wouldn't do it to Islam, and we all know that. We know what would have happened. Paris would have been burning by now. So it was the story was breaking. I went back and watched the – I never watched the Olympics anymore. I've got to say that probably two Olympics ago I decided that it was – well, once they let the trans – once Laurel Hubbard got in there and – but even before that I'd gone off the whole spectacle. I know the sport's the main thing, and I agree with you, Peter, and it's still a beautiful thing, but – I just don't really watch it anymore because I feel that the IOC is about as corrupt as they get. And watching that, because I had to see what was going on, I was laughing and crying in turns. It was probably one of the grossest spectacles I've ever seen. And it's interesting, you were in New York, Peter, and the American media, of course, are very safe about these sorts of things. But here's a country that's pushing the trans and mutilation of kids so hard that, you know, they don't want to show that opening ceremony with testicles hanging out and you know, the hefty lady. I love that, the hefty lady. But, you know, they're quite happy to have a whole, you know, world of trans mutilation going on and all the money associated with that. So it's a very interesting world at the moment. And the Olympics is, I'm not watching it anymore. I really can't abide it. I love sport, but it just turns me off. So that was what I saw. And yeah, it was one of the most terrible things I've ever seen, to be honest.
Yeah, it's not commonly the link isn't commonly made to it being a black mass. It's my particular thing, once I started researching what a black mass was, it's all there. And Simon O'Connor wrote a very good column about the mocking Christianity aspect of it. And he went out of the political panel yesterday before I could challenge him on why he's not willing to say, look, it's satanic. And I'm not an especially religious person. But,
oh, it's satanic. Yeah, it's satanic, all right.
It's obviously satanic. And if I may run an idea up the flagpole, people, I think, might be slowly starting to understand that they are not the real customers of media companies. The real customers seem to be those impossibly wealthy Satanists who hate God, love to rape and mutilate and corrupt children, want 90% fewer of us on earth, and ultimately own the companies that pay for the majority of advertising. So it's probably no surprise that the media they want to advertise on is so distasteful to us intolerant transphobes.
Yeah, and I think there's a similar theme emerging as well with this latest boxing fiasco. I watched it last night. Imani Khalif of Algeria, who is an androgynous boxer, an androgynous person, born female, has a vagina, but also has XY chromosomes, is, I guess you'd say, a natural person, but is a very unusual natural person. I think it's 0.5% of the population can be classed as androgynous, but is essentially a male in a female's body. That's something she can't help, but it means that when it comes to a sport like boxing, she has this immense advantage and just thumped the poor Italian fighter last night. And there's another one coming up this weekend, a Taiwanese boxer who is the same sort of natural physical specimen. I mean, this is not trans athletes as such, because these athletes did not transition from male to female, but they have massive advantages. It's happened before with the South African athlete Caster Semenya, who was also an athlete running in women's competition with XY chromosomes and won two Olympic gold medals and was a fantastic athlete. That's a non-contact sport. She has been banned from her specialist event now because of the way she was born. The IOC, though, have not seen fit to ban these two boxers, even though they have massive physical advantage in a contact sport. And the Italian quit after 46 seconds last night after copping two big thumping blows, knew that she was in danger, and got out of the game. I suspect the same sort of thing is going to happen in the featherweight division when the Taiwanese boxer gets in the ring as well. But the fact that the IOC has effectively allowed and almost encouraged this thing to happen under the headline of inclusiveness and fairness is just outrageous. And this is another monstrous black mark against the International Olympic Committee.
It's something that the International Boxing Federation, I think, doesn't allow. So it's quite a break just with conventional sport, isn't it? Anything else to say on the Olympics, Rachel? Are you?
Oh, well, it's a shame, because when you're a kid, you remember, you know, sitting up all hours of the night and watching and listening, and it's just over for me. I mean, unless something shifts radically, I just can't watch it and don't want any part of that kind of thing anymore. And I feel that, you know, I remember Laurel Hubbard standing there and Gavin Laurel Hubbard, and, you know, that just, I just couldn't believe my eyes. And, yeah, I just can't be involved in any of that now. I just turn off. That's all I have to say about that.
Yeah, it's hard to watch. And it brings us to our next topic arising from that disconnect. TVNZ is set to launch more cost-saving moves, with the trade union fearful of another round of job losses. And this was comprehensively reported in Shane Curry's, as you said earlier, Peter, it was an excellent New Zealand Herald Media Insider section this week. Management have initiated, this is Air 2 Union saying, management have initiated this process with the claim they need to increase their annual earnings by $30 million by either increasing revenue or reducing costs, said Air 2 negotiation specialist Michael Wood, of course, he of the River of Filth descriptor. Peter, what are you make of your previous employer's loss of revenue?
Well, they say they have to save $30 million. That's because their budgeted loss for this current financial year is $28 to $32 million. So they've rounded it out to the midpoint and said they've got to save $30 million. I note that their full-time, or their headcount of full-time equivalent employees has already dropped from 700 to, is it 670 or 630, and is going to reduce further. I mean, it's just the way of the world, isn't it? The big question is, how much is news and current affairs going to be affected? Are they going to cut back on their news services? They've already lost the midday news. They've already lost the Sunday program. They've already lost Fair Go. I mean, is the 6 p.m. news due for a reformatting to make it half an hour and therefore save money in that respect? I honestly don't know. I also hear that since the demise of News Hub, the total audience for their 6 p.m. news has increased. Well, that's hardly a surprise. The question is, does it get the appropriate yield from advertising to make it a highly profitable one-hour program between 6 and 7? So, yeah, look, it's 6 years since I've been employed at TVNZ, Marty. I don't know too much about what's going on there now. In fact, I know nothing about what's going on there now. All I know is what I read. I know that it's going to make a loss this year of $30 million. It seems to me you have to address that, because the government cannot keep on, or the banks cannot keep on bailing out what is effectively a broke organisation. So they've got to save money big time. And the easiest way to do that is to cut back on payroll.
Mm. Rachel, I meant to have you lead off that one, but we'd sort of had that initial discussion and I messed it up. What are your thoughts on this? Sorry?
Oh, no, Peter should definitely have led that one. He worked for them for long enough. My thoughts are that the issue is so much deeper, of course, and we all know what that is that people aren't watching. I cannot watch TV1. I haven't, again. It doesn't make me better than anyone else or worse than anyone else. I'm not trying to be an elitist about this. In any way, I just cannot abide them. I certainly went off them over COVID, the COVID period. Occasionally we'd check in. My partner and I would have a laugh to see what they were saying, and the shots from Britain with all the patients, you know, lying there dying in their beds. But then you realise they'd showed that before and they'd said it was New York one time and London the next time. So to me, TVNZ's a dead duck. I know what Michael Wood would say and has said in his statement was that, you know, in a functioning democracy, you need the, you know. Well, I'm sorry, but this is the reason the democracy isn't functioning is things like RNZ and radio and TV1. And the sooner governments get out of this business, the better, because this is a dying industry and I don't think there's any way back from that. It's probably, there's so many things we can't fix anymore, and I think media is probably one of them. It just has to do what it naturally does, like whaling. You know, we stopped whaling a few years ago. We probably need to stop journalism. In that way, I don't think we can keep forcing this anymore. It's just it just isn't happening. We're not producing the people to do good journalism. They're not coming out of journalism schools with any idea of balance. And yeah, I think it's over, and the sooner the better.
If you take the more cynical idea about why that's so, that they've taken that canary out of the coal mine. You alluded to the need for quality journalism in a functional democracy. I mean, is it a cynical move that it is so bad that they've stopped journalists questioning what the government's doing, as you saw really, really taking off in COVID, as you said before?
I think, I don't know if it's cynical, it just feels like an agenda. I mean, it just feels like, it's like in America now with Kamala Harris being rebranded. It's, you know, one minute she is what she is, which is probably the worst vice president we've ever seen since Dan Quayle. But even now he looks like a, you know, intellectual giant compared to her. But suddenly in a week she's you have a media that just does the bidding of whatever the current, where the money's coming from, I guess. So it's corrupt. Yeah, we just follow the money and it's corrupt. And yeah, so I guess that's about as cynical as it gets. We've got to that point now, I think.
Yeah, it's when you know that they know that you know they're lying, that it get you yeah. get that sort of icy feeling in your stomach, don't you? They're not even.
Yeah, they don't care, and they don't care. No.
It wouldn't really matter if this was privately owned media, because privately owned media can, frankly, as RCR does, it can do and say what it likes. If you're not owned by the government, you can take whatever editorial stance you like. And that, in many respects, is the way that the great American media model has evolved over the last century, in that the television networks, the radio stations, are owned by private enterprise with very little government involvement in the media industry at all. And that's great. New Zealand, sadly, of course, has gone completely the other way. We're coming up to, 100 years of state-owned broadcasting, state-run broadcasting in this country. And as Rachel says, frankly, it's time the government got out of it. We might not be a big enough economy to support much of a broadcasting industry. Well, so be it. Would it matter if there is not a big broadcasting industry the way we have at the moment? In fact, as I've said for the last 30 years, ever since we deregulated the game back in, 1989, New Zealand has been the most broadcast-to nation in the world. We have way too many radio stations, way too many television outlets for a population of 5 and a bit million. Frankly, it doesn't matter if a few of them fall over. We've seen News Hub go. There will be many more. It does not matter. The market will determine what survives.
Mm. The tough thing is, as I said earlier, I remember seeing Tucker Carlson recount a meeting he had with a pharmaceutical executive, and he said to him, "Why do you guys advertise so much? Is it effective for you?" And they said, "Well, no, it's not effective in terms of selling products, but it's effective at controlling what they talk about." Yeah. And that's the danger, you know. If you see non-government owned media as pure as the driven snow, it's not always so. The RCR model, it always amuses me seeing Radio New Zealand hanging in, getting this $24 million funding increase, which is a multitude of times more than what RCR costs to run a year, although it should cost more. And there's also some complaints that the various state-owned media, not only they're losing money, but there's concern that they're dropping those programs, as you said earlier. And former broadcasting minister and New Zealand's Al Sharpton, Willie Jackson, at a select committee meeting, fired a broadside at TVNZ chair Alistair Carruthers, the man he appointed to the role last year. This is again from Shane Curry's article, saying it had been a huge disappointment that the TVNZ board didn't step up to support high-quality news programs such as Sunday and Fair Go when they were earmarked for closure. And RNZ chief executive Paul Thompson also came under scrutiny at the committee hearing from Jackson, who said, "Are Māori programs just on the weekend? Is that what you're saying?" He said, "I would have thought Monday to Friday was more important." So he's saying there's not enough Māori content on Radio New Zealand. What are our thoughts about what a state-owned broadcaster should do?
A state-owned broadcaster should tell both sides of the story. In fact, it's written in legislation that it offers balanced news. Now, anybody who listens to RNZ, and I haven't for some time, anybody who watches TV One News, and I haven't for some time, for pretty much the same reasons as Rachel has outlined, I understand that there's not too much in the way of balance there. So if they are going to exist and be state-funded, they've got to tell both sides of the story, and it's been patently obvious for a very long time now that they don't. And therefore, I find them both lacking in credibility.
Rachel, what do you think? Is there room for a central news agency that maybe just comes out with facts that other journalists can use? So at least we're having different interpretations of something that's verifiable or verified.
There's definitely room for it. That's what we want, isn't it? But look, I just remember RNZ's. And maybe I saw it differently, but RNZ in the 90s, 2000s was pretty much, you could listen to them, they were reliable, you felt you were getting both sides of the story, there wasn't an agenda, the Māori content was not like it is now, of course, and maybe it did need to move a bit on that, but I think now it's too much in terms of an agenda, not so much too much in terms of language because the language is beautiful. But, those days are gone. And yes, there's room, but we're not churning out the journalists to even do it. We just don't have them. We haven't got that depth anymore. So, yeah, I don't see it happening. I think we should be out of the business now.
Did you train as a journalist? What training as a journalist did you
do? I went to WIT in late in my 40s in New Plymouth, actually, before it shut down. Just decided to – I'd always written, but I just decided to formalise it. So I went to WIT, but the year after I finished, they shut down. So, yes, I did. I did. But, you know, I was in my 40s and it was a late run. And so that's 20 years ago. I'm 60 now. And unbelievably, I know it's hard to tell. it was – even then it was starting to shift. And I had a tutor who was so left-wing and I had to kind of work around her. And it was, you know, and I was an adult. And I was doing a lot of it online, but going to lectures in town because I was living in New Plymouth at the time. And, I had to work around her all the time. So I could already see the kind of direction we were going in. And, you know, the days of, great journalism schools are over.
Yeah. So, Rachel, even back in those days, did you feel as if you had to write assignments to agree with the world view of your lecturer if you were going to get a pass mark and get your diploma and your piece of paper at the end of the course?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I figured out very quickly that I hated every second of it, but I just focused on the end goal. But yes, definitely. And she was my age probably at the time, maybe. Yeah, I think she was exactly my age actually. And you just had to work around your sensibilities. And of course, in those days, 20 years ago, I probably was a lot more to the left than I certainly am not now. And the world wasn't quite so crazy. So you could kind of, you know, the pressure wasn't as high. You just would just go along with it. But now, of course, you'd have to go along with it. And actually, most kids going through journalism school now, or young people, I shouldn't say all kids, they're pretty have their biases and they're encouraged to have them. They're actually encouraged to have them now. That's a fact.
Well, they're indoctrinated. I came to journalism very late, and I just trained on the job at the Gisborne Herald. But I'd studied geology at university, so it was back in the early 90s when my professors were still saying, "Look, it doesn't work as a theory. It's a UN tax grab, etc."
Talking about climate change here and the IPCC and anthropogenic global warming and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I had a pretty good insight into that. So when I started, it was Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth had just come out, and I wrote quite a few columns saying, well, look, that doesn't add up and it's not going to happen. 15 or so years down the line, what I said was correct, but I wouldn't be able to print that in that paper. They stopped printing anything that questioned the narrative. Those woes of financial viability are not confined to state-owned broadcasters by any means. Again, Shane Curry's Media Insider this week discussed the dire state of Warner Brothers Discovery's New Zealand finances, which have been laid bare, and they've suffered a massive $138 million loss in 2023, which included a $79.5 million impairment. Now I have to look up what impairment means. For those of you who share my ignorance, an impairment is in accounting is a permanent reduction in the value of an asset to less than its carrying value. In layman's terms, they're in the crap. Paddy Gower has issues.
Yeah. So what it means is that Warner Brothers Discovery took an $80 million impairment, $138 million loss overall. So that suggests that their cash loss, their operating loss, was in the vicinity of about $50 million, which is in round terms probably about $20 million more than the cost of News Hub. I know at TVNZ in my day, the news budget was around about $30, $35 million. It might be a bit higher these days with inflation in the last 5 or 6 years. So News Hub probably cost about the same to run. Therefore, it was obviously untenable. Hence, they close it down. But just their general lack of ratings for other programming as well. suggests that their advertising income was nowhere near covering the cost of operation. So what have they got? Their parent company in the US is happy to bail them out for now, but only for another, is it 1 year or 2 years? So what we're looking at, because the economic outlook for Warner Brothers Discovery is surely not going to improve. Their programming is basically crap. No more people are going to watch their programs in the next couple of years. Advertising may or may not come back, but either way, they're not going to be able to become a profitable operation. So what does that tell us? Probably in a couple of years, TV3 might be off the air, or just very much a niche replay type of broadcaster with no local production at all, just showing reruns of The Munsters and the Donna Reed Show. Well, I'm being a bit facetious there, but you know what I mean? Just basically stuff out of the library of greatest hits from years gone by. So, yeah, it's sad, but it's reality and it's the market talking. People don't want to watch broadcast linear television anymore.
Mm. Rachel, are you watching much TV these days?
A little bit less lately because I'm sort of busy hunting at the moment. I'm away. So, no. But I have done a lot. But, you know, it's changed. Like, what's interesting about America is I was watching I did watch Megyn Kelly last night. And she was talking to the ABC in Australia about something, the guy there, Darren, can't think of his name, bearded guy. And she was just saying, look, you know, Americans aren't wanting the CNNs anymore. They're not wanting this as much. So now she's huge. So is Tucker Carlson. So is Dave Rubin, the Rubin Report. So, and she said, you know, this is where it's going and America's getting it too. So I'm looking at TV that's definitely over there somewhere. You know, you go looking for what you feel comfortable with, and I feel comfortable getting my news about the Trump assassination attempt, for instance, from Megyn Kelly and Dave Rubin, and maybe people will call me a right-wing conspiracy theorist, but that's where I'm going to actually hear the truth, I think, or something approximating it.
I find the right-left spectrum makes a lot more sense if you think of the left as wanting more government and less freedom, and the right wanting less government and more freedom. And by that measure, I'm certainly right-wing. And I mean, I recently got back onto X again. I'm on there as Marty Gibson under my own name. And it's jarring the difference in coverage. For instance, with the recent assassination attempt on Donald Trump, you know, you can watch Navy SEAL snipers talk about that doesn't happen. You don't have a roof unguarded like that ever. They're looking at it in advance.
Yeah.
Got the New Zealand media saying, well, it seems legit.
I'm with you,
Mark. Exactly.
I found far more about the Trump assassination attempt on X than I did anywhere else. And I'm still waiting for answers to a whole lot of questions. And frankly, it's not been helped by the Secret Service head resigning because she went before she could answer those questions appropriately. So I find that what I get from X is so much more fun. The problem is that X, from a New Zealand perspective, has been taken over by the critics of the government, and you know the post after post slamming the coalition government is quite extraordinary, really. But then when I think about it, they probably deserve it.
Yeah, well, I'm not necessarily one or the other. But, I mean, arguably one of the reasons mainstream media got so out of step with the New Zealand public is because Jacinda Ardern's government paid the piper via the Public Interest Journalism Fund, and Kiwis don't always like the tune called. As a condition of that funding system, which people forget continues to this day. And some of those conditions include how recipients report on issues affecting Māori. Of course, they must assume, among other things, that Te Tiriti is a partnership in which Māori retain sovereignty and that New Zealand is a racist country that systemically disadvantages Māori, with three of the conditions I seem to remember. And Peter, I know you've been following the reporting in the media following the Court of Appeal lowering the bar, allowing iwi to claim ownership over most of New Zealand's coastline. And there hasn't been a lot of resistance, has there, in the media?
No, far from it. And what you've got to remember is, you know, the basic rule of New Zealand's constitution. Parliament is the lawmaker in this country. Parliament is the highest court in the land. It decides what our country or how our country should operate. A previous government put in place this this particular piece of legislation, when was it, 2011? And the Court of Appeal, and firstly the High Court and then the Court of Appeal, decided it didn't like the legislation, so it changed it, which is just extraordinary. And now the government is saying, we're in charge here. We're changing the law back to the way that we intended it in the first place. So the constitution, such as it is in New Zealand unwritten, says that Parliament makes the law, the courts interpret it. The courts interpret it in a way that the Parliament didn't like, or the government didn't like, hence it's being changed. I note the TV1 commentary on it from their Maori Affairs correspondent, which has taken the appropriate attitude. There will be no denial of access to beaches to New Zealanders by Maori because of the legislation, which I presume is true, but it's not that. It's the point and the interpretation of the legislation, the introduction of tikanga, and this bizarre, almost oxymoronic expression, which I think came up in Justice Churchman's original call on the Edwards case in the Eastern Bay of Plenty, because you remember that part of the legislation said that an iwi can get customary marine title if they can prove they've had exclusive use and exclusive access to this particular piece of the foreshore since 1840. Justice Churchman came up with this outrageous statement called shared exclusivity. I mean,
it's a Canadian concept, isn't it?
Yeah, go figure. Mm. So the government basically is changing the law back to the way it was originally meant to operate, and good for them, because they can do that. They are the highest court in the land. If there's a change of government, it might be changed again.
And it's the canary in the coal mine thing again. You know, if you had someone like Muriel Newman alongside the One News reporter you mentioned earlier, Te Aniwa Huru, Huri Hanga Nui, New Zealanders be able to make more informed decisions on their position, I guess, and the implications of it. Have you been watching this, Rachel?
Well, I haven't, but it's we're not going to get the coverage that we need, and New Zealanders aren't going to hear both sides, and so here we are again. You know, we're just in the dark, really, a lot of the time, unless we go looking. And there's only one narrative anyway, so, you know, what do you do?
One of the issues you've been interested in is the use of AI to generate news. Have you been able to spot AI-generated news so far?
No, not really, because I don't spend a lot of time looking at the New Zealand Herald, who have just been pinged, obviously, for doing it and not telling people, because apparently that's, you have to say that it was AI-generated, so they didn't do that. It was on the All Blacks the other day about who would they put on the team or whatever. But Murray Kirkness said, you know, we should have had more rigor and journalists should have overseen what was going on there. Yes, well, maybe just don't use AI. But, you know, I'm just a, what do I know? The whole issue of AI just does my head in. It's crazy. We're going to have more of it. We'll have less journalists, which may not be a bad thing. But, yeah, the AI thing, they've got to be absolutely clear about the fact they're using it, and they weren't. They did two articles over, I think, the last week and got pinged by Media Watch. So, yeah, it's a coming problem. And what do you need journalists for if you've got AI?
Well, it's an obvious solution to the financial woes of New Zealand media, isn't it? To replace the highly paid figurative robots who work in mainstream media with real robots. Peter, are you worried about being replaced by robots?
No, of course I am, because the worst thing about the robots is that they've got to get their intelligence from somewhere. The term AI, artificial intelligence, is somewhat of a misnomer, because the intelligence that is then regurgitated or printed has already been created by somebody else. So in that respect, it's not artificial at all. It has been written, researched, dreamt up by somebody and put into the big wide internet or Ethernet or cloud or whatever, and the AI algorithm has reached into this big cloud, pulled down the appropriate information and regurgitated it in the English language in a form which is mostly grammatically correct. So it's not artificial in that respect. It's the old rubbish in, rubbish out kind of thing. So you frame your question to the artificial intelligence tool appropriately, you'll get the angle on the story or angle on the editorial that you want.
Kind of. I see the other day that someone tested it on the Trump assassination, and they AI came back and said, we don't have enough information on this to help you. But then you put in something about Kamala Harris and it was just screeds and screeds of wonderful things that she had done. It's funny, you know, I've got a rural background, I think everyone kind of knows, and it doesn't matter how many times I hear the word AI, I just think artificial insemination. So, that kind of works too for me. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, then further downstream from that, you've got systems like NewsGuard, which are very left-leaning, and you've got those intelligence agencies curating the various algorithms using AI and have been since 2017. So I think most New Zealanders aren't aware of the extent to which the media that's reaching them is already curated by AI. Certainly, you know, there was also... saw a lot of if people Google Trump, as you say, there's a lot turn up about Kamala.
You put in President Donald, and up comes President Donald Duck. That was the first thing in Google that came up the other day. People were testing it, so you just can't. Google's just completely complicit in shutting this down. But anyway, yeah.
Well, I guess we've just got to keep asking why and cue bono.
Why? Yeah.
It gives an unsettling answer, doesn't it?
It's not good.
Yeah. I mean, I've been pretty adept at spotting press releases which have just been knocked into shape and given a byline. You know, they've been there for quite a while. It's a hungry beast, as you know, a newspaper. So it's very tempting for a journalist who's expected to write 3 to 5 stories a day if they can just put an intro on something and... You spot that by the lack of balance primarily.
You do get an eye for this stuff, that's for sure.
The Radio New Zealand wrote an article on this saying the Herald and other NZME publications use AI to improve our journalism. In some cases, we also create stories entirely using AI tools, says an explanatory article headlined NZME New Zealand Herald and our use of AI. We believe that smart use of AI allows us to publish better journalism. We remain committed to our code of ethics and to the integrity of our journalism, regardless of whether or not we use AI tools to help with the production or processing of articles. And Dr. Greg Treadwell, who's the co-author of the annual AUT Trust in News report, told Midday Report it was a poor experiment in AI use. I think New Zealanders have to be realistic about the fact AI is going to work its way into the production of news, but I think the Herald has kind of admitted this was a pretty poor experiment in it for a number of reasons, I think. His concern was that if you ask AI to take a position, it will, and if you ask it to take another position, it will take that position. What is lacking here, even if you ask AI to take positions, is the original argument we would look to our senior journalists to put into the public domain for us about important issues. So it's sort of almost pretending they don't have a position themselves.
Yeah, but also, as with all journalism, all reporting, it comes down to asking the right questions. Now, people say it's much easier to be a journalist these days because we've got the internet, because we've got Google, because we've got search engines, which is true. It means that you don't need to go to the library. It means you don't need to go to those piles and piles of old newspaper archives the way we used to have to go in days gone by if you wanted to research a story. But it's still the same question. It just makes the process quicker. You still have to research and find things out yourself by using the internet, and there is nothing wrong with that because the internet is a veritable, it's the ultimate in libraries, isn't it? The question then is, do you publish all the facts and do you publish all sides of the story? And I come back to what I said before about the AI tool. If you ask an AI program to write a story for you on a particular angle, you give it that angle, it will spew out the story angled the way you want it. You're not going to get the balance because it's the old rubbish in, rubbish out kind of thing. At least with a real person doing the research and a journalist who is properly trained to give a balanced report, then you will have a balanced story once all the research has been done, no matter where you get the information and the evidence from, whether it be from the library, from a pile of old newspapers, or from the Google search engine.
Anything else on AI, Rachel? Are you
just that I'm more comfortable with that. No, never. Oh, God, no. No, and I don't use artificial insemination either.
I tell you what, Marty, I was asked to write a speech or do a speech for a small rural community in Southland for Anzac Day last year. And this was when ChatGPT was sort of all the rage. And I thought I'll just go on to ChatGPT and asked them to write me a speech for Anzac Day at Waikaka Valley. Put it this way, it wasn't very good. It was full of cliches. It was so boring, I would have fallen asleep reading it. So I thought, well, the hell with that. I screwed it up and wrote my own, and it was much better received.
Well, I have heard of a prominent media, alternative media personality in New Zealand who sometimes appears on RCR, whose name I won't reveal, wrote a very fulsome apology using AI. Quite good for that.
Okay, I'll remember that.
And that's, I think that, speaking of that person, there was an article about that person's new platform, The Good Oil. This is Cam Slater I'm talking about. It was looking at that bias issue. And he looked at Guy and Espina's story that he's been circulating, saying that the government set aside $216 million to pay for heated tobacco products, and was running through the convoluted mathematics that you needed to go through to arrive at that figure, which is actually more like a $3 million reduction in tax take by reducing the tax on heated rather than burnt tobacco products, on the basis that they're less harmful than cigarettes. And so that figure has arrived at once you assume that there's going to be greater use of it, as there has been in other countries that have tried it.
When you say heated tobacco products, do you mean vaping?
I think so, but it may be just vaporized actual tobacco rather than oil-based nicotine. There's about 600 users, I think, of it in New Zealand at the moment, so it can't be vaping because there'd be more than that.
Okay, all right.
It's all part of the continuing attack on Casey Costello. From the moment Casey, who I know and like through my time at the Taxpayers Union, from the moment she set foot in Parliament, the media were onto her. I don't know what they don't like about her. Maybe it's the fact that she's a conservative Maori woman. Maybe it's the fact that she used to be the vice president of the police association. Maybe it's the fact that she's been a successful entrepreneur in the security industry. I don't know, but for some reason, they just don't like her. So they've been on her case from the off. And this is just another example of it.
Yeah. Well, Karen Chua springs to mind, you know, for Ed. Yeah. And yeah. What's
wrong
going
kind
on
of Maori,
for
Rachel. Wrong kind of Maori.
Wrong kind of Maori. That's right. Yeah. Say the right kind of Maori. Yeah. Yeah. It's very strange.
It's been very, very sad. And it's been interesting, though, it was interesting to see Karen's very visceral reaction just to the toxicity of that place and the bullying culture that is behind.
But, you know, you only get bullied if you're a left, you know, we only care about people being bullied if they're left, if they're at the Green Party or the Labour Party, but we don't care about, you know, some right-wing bigoted Maori woman, you know, she deserves everything she gets. And it's just so awful. And obviously it's very awful for her because she really cares about her culture and where she comes from. And she just doesn't present it in the way they want it presented. It's like I'm a lesbian. I don't present gay politics how they wanted them presented because I don't believe in the T part of the LGBT. I don't like pride parades, and I don't like any of the politicization of it. So, you know, if you're not the right kind of lesbian or the right kind of Maori, you're toast. And we see it over and over again. The media hates you too. You know, I get heaps in the media, still do. Even though I'm not in the media anymore, I still get talked about. So it's, you know, you've got to be the right kind.
Yeah, I often say that Reality Check Radio, you'd think, would be more widely celebrated, being started by three very strong, capable women and hosting discussions such as this with people who, you know, might not on paper appear to get along as well as we have this morning, this afternoon. But it's quite the opposite.
Yeah, well, women still get it. They still do, especially if you're capable and strong. We still do. It's just a fact. But you're going to get supported if your goal is Garanam, or Chloe Swarbrick. But they're the right kind, and we're not. So it's the way it is, sadly.
Well, Cubino. That's pretty much, I think, the Fourth Estate for another week. It seems like the world's getting too fast at times, even for the 24-hour news cycle to keep up, doesn't it? Yes. Any thoughts before we close on where this is all heading? Or
I just want to make one other quick comment, getting back to TVNZ, Marty. I noticed that their very short-lived breakfast presenter, Kamal Santamaria, has got a document drop about his dismissal. He had a very short-lived career as the breakfast host, you might remember, before he was discovered or before it was decided that he was a bit too touchy-feely with people around the office. I know nothing about what actually happened or what sort of personality the man is. I've never met him, never worked with him. But I just find it intriguing that amongst the documents that he has obtained from TVNZ, I guess through the Official Information Act, there is criticism of him before he even arrived in the building. So it appears as if, and this is going to be a really intriguing employment dispute, as if it continues, and I understand he's mortgaged his house to take out a fight against TVNZ because of it. If he can prove that TVNZ or people at TVNZ were biased against him before he even arrived in the building, before he even started work in this new role, then it's going to be pretty interesting about the employment dispute. I don't know whether or not he's had a payment or whether he was just summarily dismissed after his, 32 days fronting breakfast. But, gee, the bias against him before he even arrived in the building is not a good look for TVNZ. That's all I can say about that, as was reported this morning.
Mm. Well, watch that space. Rachel, anything before you load up and go out and looking for something fairy to shoot?
Yeah, and eat. We'll just put the eating part in there too. And eat, always eat. Just that the media has to go through. I think we're going through incredible times. It's a fascinating time to be alive and an incredibly worrying time. But the media is in huge state of decline. And I think we're just going to have to go through it and pick up what we can from the rubble. And I don't have any, I don't do the Paddy Gower number where it's all so very sad and I've lost my job and it's, you know, all this stuff. I'm just brutal about it, and it's over. And I think we just have to accept that and carry on and see what comes of it.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I'll take Paul Brennan's breakfast show yesterday as an example, just the quality of breakfast journalism on display there is something that you don't even come close to seeing on these huge, expensive terrestrial broadcasting channels. So, I mean, I hope that RCR continues to grow and fill that space. Here's hoping.
Yeah, and I won't go on with anyone else. That's what I've said. Unless things change, I'll only come on RCR now.
Well, thanks for joining us, Rachel. It's been great to have a chat for the first time.
Thank you.
And it's been a heavenly hymn of journalistic analysis. So go off and have a great weekend. Peter, thanks very much to you too.
Absolute pleasure, Marty. Nice to meet you, Peter.
Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to The Fourth Estate right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio. Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.